From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
I am thrilled to welcome George Schlatter back to the show this week. I hope you were listening a few months ago when we talked about George Schlatter's career and his new memoir, Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy, from the creator of Laugh-In. And this was a lot of stuff that I wanted to ask him about that I didn't have time for in our first discussion, so I'm grateful he's made time for a second visit. George Schlatter,
welcome. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Your memoir is now out in paperback, and that's really good news because anyone who loves to laugh should go get a copy right now. And it's nice when things, you know, last a while. Last time we spoke, we briefly mentioned your TV series, Turn On, which had a legendary legendary short run. I wanted to ask you, now on your YouTube page, it actually says that it never aired in California, but I know that's not so because I saw it and I lived in LA when it was on. So,
well, they've now found the tape and they've released it out here, and nobody can understand what the problem was. Well, story was the guy, the Turn On came on and the guy in Cleveland wanted to keep Peyton Place on. And so he started calling stations saying, we can't allow this. And he went all the way across the country calling these stations. So it was, Turn On was canceled one station at a time. But there was nothing offensive about it. It was just a very provocative, new wave kind of television.
It wasn't sexy or anything.
No, it was just fast, and it was fragmented, and it was super fast, and it was about issues and so forth. But the problem with it was this guy in Cleveland called everybody and wanted them to put Peyton Place back on the air. Turn On remains a legend. And now, fortunately, somebody found the tape and they're re-releasing it. And nobody can understand what the problem was.
Yes, I watched it on YouTube, and it was fun to see it again because I hadn't seen it since the first time it aired. And I was a big Laugh-In fan. And I think Laugh-In was a very sexy show. It was much sexier than Turn On.
Yes.
The sexiest thing about Turn On was the name Turn On, I guess.
Yes. And Laugh-In was just so fragmented that it felt like something you had to see again to be sure of what you just looked at. But Laugh-In was an adventure. I had loved that show.
Well, I loved it too. It was, you know, I guess it was the first must-see TV in my life. And I never missed it. And you not only got great guests on the show, but you got them to do strange things. You got John Wayne to dress as a bunny. How were you able to get all these stars to be on the show?
What happened was Laugh-In came on and they had nothing to put on opposite Lucille Ball and Gunsmoke, which was the number one and the number two show. So I came in and I said, well, I'll give you a show with all unknown people. And so they said, okay, because they had nothing else to put on. So we put it on the air, and it was all new. It was all new people and new ideas and new editing techniques and sound effects and so forth. And so it was on for like 3 weeks before anybody really figured it out. And we didn't have any money to buy guest stars. So I would go out in the hall and get people on the way down from the Johnny Carson show in the hallway. We'd go to people in the hallway to get them to do something. Like John Wayne said, I'm not going to do that show. I don't want to be on that show. That's what we aired. And we got everybody in the hallway and got quite a lineup of guest stars, none of whom realized that they were going to be on television. Laugh-In was an adventure. It was me, very young and very outrageous and not content. I'd been doing like the Dinosaur Chevy show and the Judy Garland series and so forth, and I wanted to do something different, and we had no money, so we stopped people in the hallway. And then once John Wayne realized the impact that it had, we even talked him into wearing that giant bunny suit. John Wayne was not blessed with a great sense of humor, but
no.
Didn't show anyway.
Well, in your book, Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy, you talk about your early days in television and becoming a producer. How did you become a producer? You said in your book that carnivals played a role in building your producer mentality?
Well, everything did, and I'm convinced now I can tell the truth. I think I became a producer because I failed at everything else. It was just, there was television, and it was new, and I knew these young character people, and since NBC had nothing to put on opposite Lucy and Gunsmoke, which were number one and two show, so I went in and I said, I'll give you a show, and it'll cost you nothing, but let me do whatever I want. And so they bought it kind of by mistake. And so by the time of three shows went on, the audience said, wait a minute, something's happening here. And then it went on the air, and from then on, it just exploded. And we got up to a 50 share. And I'm arrogant, you know, 20 share, but with a 50 share, forget about it. And
well, I wonder, there's a sort of a subtext in your book, that you would rather have done the show without Rowan and Martin? Did you find Rowan and Martin to be a pain?
Oh, no, I couldn't sell the show without a host because it was so wild and so different. And so the Timex, who was a great friend of mine, Jim Ellers, would buy it only with a host. So we had Rowan and Martin did a great nightclub act, and so we brought them on as the hosts, and Dan was straight and Dick was silly. And so they opened and closed and then did a couple of other pieces in the show. But the show originally was designed without a host, and it worked with Rowan and Martin. And
but let's be honest, did you like Rowan and Martin, George?
What?
Did you like Rowan and Martin? You can be honest with us, George.
Yeah, well, they were good friends of mine, and they did a great nightclub act, but it had nothing to do with Laugh-In. It's just the fact that to get Timex to buy it, we had Rowan and Martin host it, and it worked because they were so straight. Dan was straight, and Dick was silly. And I had a good time with them.
And did they like each other?
Huh?
I say, did they like each other?
No, they never. Once they came off stage after the show, they never saw or talked to each other again until the next time they came out on stage. They did not really have a close relationship. But that even worked, you know, because Dick was so silly and Dan was so straight. And he was kind of the parental guidance of Dick Martin. And it worked.
He seems maybe like Dan Rowan was maybe a little arrogant.
Well, Dan was very literate. Dan was a very, you know, intelligent, literate, articulate man. And Dick was just silly. And they would come out and Dick would just ramble for 4 or 5 minutes. We'd cut that down to 2 minutes and then say, okay, let's go to the party. And it worked. They worked because they were charming and attractive and totally outside of that sphere of craziness that was going on, and it worked. I'm glad it did.
How many writers did you employ on Laugh-In?
12. At one point it was 14, and at one point it was 5. So it bounced in and out. The writers were also outcasts. They were writers. They were not variety show writers, and they were not sitcom writers. They were just funny guys, and they came in with all of these ideas. And give me a page, and we put that on the air. So the writers were crazy and outrageous outcasts and totally irreverent and non-political. The show had no political foundation other than the fact we were against everything, but in a funny way.
Well, I don't know if they were your rivals, but I mean your contemporaries at CBS, the Smothers Brothers, they were the political version of Laugh-In, maybe.
Yes, I loved the Smothers Brothers. Tommy and I were really, really seriously good friends. And we would use them as an example. NBC would say we couldn't say something. We'd say, well, we could say it if we were on the Smothers Brothers. I really enjoyed my relationship with them. And we used them kind of as the buffer. And we said, well, you could do that if we were on the Smothers Brothers. Smothers Brothers were more of a straight variety show because they did music. And all of that, but and they were young and vibrant, and I liked those guys a lot. But they then said that they canceled the show because Tommy wouldn't send CBS the tapes, which was a lie. Tommy sent them the tapes, but they wanted to get rid of that political abrasive comedy, and that's exactly what I was looking for. So CBS canceled the show because they said it because Tommy wouldn't send them the tapes. And I stayed on the air, but I sent NBC the tapes, and they would turn them down. They would say, we can't air this. I'd say, okay. And I'd send them another tape that was even more outrageous. Laugh-In was not dirty. It was just bawdy, and the energy of it, and the girls in the bikinis and all of that gave it a feeling of it's an event, and it did. It just exploded.
Well, you couldn't have had a bikini dancing go-go girl on the Dinah Shore show.
No. Dinah did not wear a bikini. But Dinah Shore show was wonderful. It was straight variety and guest stars and whatever, and Dinah. And so then NBC had nothing to put on opposite Gunsmoke and Lucy. So I said, I'll give you a show, and it'll cost you nothing. And so we put it on the air. They didn't know what it was. The first show they looked at, they said, this isn't a television show. I said, yes, this is a new television show. So NBC was quite reluctant at that time to put it on the air because nobody really could adjust to anything that was that fast and that outrageous with that many subjects and that many people in it and girls dancing in bikinis. And
were you thinking about Hell's a Poppin' or Burlesque or those kinds?
Yeah, all of that. I was a big fan of Burlesque and Hell's a Poppin'. You know, Hell's a Poppin', people remember the title, but they don't remember really what it was. Yeah. It was kind of an early, slow version of Laugh-In. But the idea of saying it's kind of a video version of Hell's a Poppin', and it was a way of explaining this new form of bright young people saying outrageous things with Goldie Hawn and in a bikini, and Lily Tomlin doing all of these wonderful characters. And it's strange the way we got them. We got Lily had two or three unfortunate experiences and was going back to New York. And she came in the office and sat down in a big chair and started becoming all of these different people. And she said, well, which characters do you want to do? And I said, I want to do them all. Well, the way we were taping, we could do them all. And so we did the first thing was Ernestine, the telephone operator. Yeah. And we aired the show. And 2 days later, she's walking down the hall. And people say, you're the new girl on Laugh-In. You got to see Ernestine to understand what she was feared, because Ernestine would call industry leaders. And is this the party to whom I am speaking, Mr. Gore Vidal? And he said, Vidal. And so she would come on and talk politics to people who did not want to talk politics in a comedy show. And that's what made it funny. But Lily was wonderful. And then, of course, you had, you know, Goldie and Judy Carn and Joanne Worley and Ruth Buzzi. They were wonderful young character people. They were not variety performers like singers been on a Dinah Shore show. We had Tony Bennett and all of those people come on and sing with Dinah. These people were just outrageous comedians coming on with different characters. And we would tape till 1-2 o'clock in the morning and then edit out anything that wasn't fast and put that on the air. And we put it on the air Monday night at 8 o'clock. And the audience, after the first week, they didn't know what the show was. The second week, the third week, the audience found it, and then it just exploded. And
the catchphrase was a big part of Laugh-In. You had a lot of great catchphrases. Very interesting. Socket.
Very interesting. It was a German, and look that up in your funkin' Wagnall. Like we say, look that up in your funkin' Wagnall. He said, "Why do you have a speech impediment?" I said, "Yeah, we just have trouble with the letter F."
Is that a chicken joke?
Is that? And then Joanne Worley came up. That's another chicken joke. See, things like that just happened. They would happen in the hallway. And so Joanne had a joke, and then there was a joke about a chicken and another joke about a chicken. So she said, hold it, is that another chicken joke? Well, that became a catchphrase. See, accident played a big part in Laugh-In because it was so fast, and the fact that NBC had nothing to put on Monday night at 8 o'clock, and so we just did things, and nobody understood what they were, including me, but they were just so fast with this group of attractive, young, irreverent people. And there was Henry Gibson played like a preacher, and Artie Johnson played a German officer. And Artie Johnson did all of these different characters.
Did you get resistance for having a Nazi character on the show?
Well, it was it was just the idea of having a German officer close the show saying goodnight to Lucy just struck everybody as an impossible thing to do. But said, goodnight, Lucy. I love you, Lucy. And so Lucy was always kind of upset that we had the German saying, "Good night, Lucy." We were opposite Lucy. And the network said, "You got to be crazy to mention your competition." I said, "My competition has a 50 share. What do you mean, crazy?" So we put it on, and us saying good night to Lucy with the German always kind of bugged her a little bit. But
about a Walnetto?
Yeah, everything. It's impossible now to describe it in today's world of whatever's going on.
Yeah.
But at that point, everything we did was brief. It was staccato and rim shots and silly music and girls in bikinis. And it was just a happening. It was like visual comedy that like they'd never seen. I had very influenced by Ernie Kovacs, who loved visual comedy.
Yeah.
And he influenced me a lot because my wife, Jolene, met Ernie at a party, and Ernie said he wanted her to do the show. And I said, "What are you doing on the show?" She said, "I don't have an idea. All I know, all she would know is Ernie would show up, bring her into the studio, and then just start doing silly things." So Ernie had a big influence on me, but as far as visual.
Yeah, well, of course, he was ahead of his time. You know, when I think back on Laugh-In, I think it was on for a long time, but it really, because I was a little kid when it came on, I was maybe 12 or 13. And then, you know, those years seemed like many, many years, but really it was only 6 years. When you look at Saturday Night Live, which has been on for 50 years or something, do you think Laugh-In could have lasted for years and years, or was it just too much of a struggle to do every week?
No, well, Lorne Michaels, we brought Lorne Michaels down from Canada to become one of the writers on Laugh-In.
Yeah.
And, he went right from the airport to Dan and Dick's dressing room. And I don't remember, Lorne was one of the great politicians in television. And look, 50 years, you know, and he managed to schmooze with the network. Where I met the network head on, Lorne managed to manipulate the network, and he's had a big success with it. But I'm kind of looking for it to do something new. I mean, it's not as funny as it was in the beginning, you know. Well, nothing ever is. But Laugh-In, do you watch it ever, see Laugh-In now?
Well, I have the box set, and I do occasionally pull out an episode and watch, and I always enjoy it.
It even feels fresh today.
Yeah.
But I don't see now, I don't see anything that's really provocative today. I don't see political, you know, certainly the climate is right to do political comedy, you know? I mean, they're doing an hour a day of the trial with the...
With Stormy Daniels?
If I was doing Laugh-In today, I would do that trial with music and rim shots. Every time I'm not a crook or whatever, bam, like we would do after a joke in the burlesque show. I'm looking at television now, and I don't see them using bright, attractive, outrageous young people. Young isn't even necessary to be young, just to be outrageous. And I'm looking for something like that. Bill Maher comes close with his political humor. Bill Maher is brilliant. But
The Daily Show? Do you watch The Daily Show?
Yeah, yeah. But what else is there?
Well, you know, that's the thing. Not only is there nothing like Laugh-In, but there's nothing like the Steve Lawrence Show or the Dinosaur Show or any of those variety shows.
Those were straight variety shows.
They don't have those either.
By accident, I looked at the first Steve Lawrence Show when we had Lucille Ball as a guest star.
Yeah.
And Steve was the last show bought by CBS, and I couldn't get anybody to do the show because Steve was not a big star. So I called Lucy, and I'd done a thing with her son, where his son had a little group, and I put them on the Dinosaur Show. So I called Lucy, and she said, "What do you want me to do? I want you to do the Steve Lawrence Show." She said, "Why would I do that show?" I said, "Well, okay, but what am I going to do with this elephant?" She said, "What?" I said, "What am I going to do with?" She said, "What elephant?" I said, "Well, I've got this pink elephant for you and Steve to ride coming through Schubert Alley at 11 o'clock on Saturday night singing together. And what am I going to do with this elephant?" She said, "I'll tell you what to do with the elephant. All right, when do you need me?" Because the idea really appealed to Lucy. And that elephant came down Schubert Alley. We got arrested. And Lucy wouldn't let me go to jail without the elephant. This was an outrageous period of time when we could do things like that. And so we put the elephant on with Lucy, and it exploded. It made the Steve Lawrence Show. And I just sent a tape of that show to David Lawrence for for him to look at. It was his father, who was a hell of a singer,
yeah,
but not a big star at that point. But that Elephant with Lucy helped launch him.
He just recently passed away.
I know. But the day I sent a tape to David, and I'm waiting for David to call me back because I would love for them to air that show again. You can't believe it.
I'd love to see it. I would love to see it.
I'll send it to you.
I wish you would. That'd be great. You know, I want to ask you about your wife. I showed you this. I love this. Can you see it? Let me see.
What is it?
It's the album cover to George Shearing Quartet and Orchestra, Black Satin. And there is the most beautiful.
My wife, Jolene. That's one of the things that helped launch Jolene's career. That album cover and Ernie Kovacs. And Ernie Kovacs did blackouts with Jolene because Jolene was gorgeous and would show up and do whatever wanted and never even ask what she was going to do. One of the famous shots is Jolene in a bathtub and a periscope comes up in the bathtub and turns around and Jolene looks back down. That shook everybody up because... But Ernie was great, and we would stay up all hours, and he would drink Liebfrau-Milch. And Ernie and I would have a beverage or a 10 and sit up and laugh. And I told him, Ernie, you're so close to a punchline, just a little snap, you know, and you got to have a punchline. He said he didn't like punchlines. And that's when I had him. I would make Ernie laugh, and Ernie was a delightful man, and we had great fun. Jolene, he made Jolene a big star, but Jolene never knew what she was going to do. She'd show up, they'd tape till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, well, how did you do? She said, well, everybody said it was good, but I don't understand what I did.
I don't listen to this record, but I have been staring at this album cover for years because she's such a good woman.
She's got a couple of album covers like that. She also had an album cover with Robert Mitchum.
Oh, Robert, yeah.
Did an album of Calypso.
Calypso.
and they invited Jolene to come in, and she showed up and posed for this album cover. You ought to take a look at it, Jolene.
Yeah, I have it in my stacks. I should go find it. But let me ask you a question about Jolene, because she's such a beautiful woman. Now, I've been reading this biography of Marilyn Monroe, and apparently Joe DiMaggio, who knew, of course, what he was getting when he married Marilyn Monroe, was constantly jealous that Marilyn Monroe was so beautiful and that people were looking at her. So you married this absolutely beautiful, showgirl. How was that?
It was great. Jolene, we hired, what happened, we were auditioning dancers for the line at Ciro's, and Jolene brought a young girl in, Barbara Huffman was her name, it was eventually Barbara Eden. Ah. So she put her in for an audition, and Herman Hoover saw Jolene and put her in the line. And I came in the next day, and Jolene's there. And I said, well, what are you doing? She said, well, Mr. Hoover hired me. So I said, okay. So we put Jolene in the line. And the next day I came in and Jolene was in front and not doing what the rest of the girls were doing, but she was gorgeous. And within about the first week or two, the whole town was talking about this beautiful young girl at Ciro's. And then Herman Hoover said we should manage her. I said, we don't know anything about managing anybody. But the idea of having meetings with Jolene to get her to sign the management contract appealed to me a lot because I got a chance to meet this gorgeous lady. And what would happen is everybody wanted to, all the guys wanted to meet Jolene, right? And they said, we want to meet Jolene. And they all said, Jolene said, everybody comes out to meet me, but nobody will ask me out because I told everybody, I said, you can talk to her, but be careful because she's going with a really ugly guy. Well, I was the ugly guy. And so when we announced that we were going to get married, all these guys said, you son of a bitch, you were the ugly guy. I said, that's right. We got married, and it was 65 years ago. And Jolene still looks like that.
Really? It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. She still looks great.
Give her my love, will you?
I will.
I'm a big fan. Speaking of things that are big, you talked about Milton Berle in your book. And there's a legendary aspect of Milton Berle that apparently you were witness to.
Well, Milton Berle was impressively endowed. They always wanted to have competitions with Milton Berle, competing with who had the larger member. And Milton would lie, he said, I'll just take out enough to beat you. Milton Berle. See, I had great fun with Milton Berle. Billy Wilder was another fan. I love Billy Wilder. And the fact is that we introduced a kind of comedy that nobody was doing at that point. And nobody was doing like one-liners and rim shots and just funny sight gags. And Milton loved that. And so did Billy Wilder. And so did, you know, all of those people would come in and enjoy just doing, they could do a guest shot and only be there for a half an hour, you know, and just drop it in throughout the show. It was a different time then. It was, television was more of an adventure then, you know. Now I see dark colors. I don't see any bright colors. I don't hear any bright, funny music. And I'm kind of disappointed, but it's going to come back. Bill Maher, does his monologues are close. Now then, if you can take that and add some color and some bright music and some pretty girls, you can come out with a new kind of television, which would explode now, I think. Because there's so much to have fun with now. There's so much to make fun of, you know?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about George Burns. I love those old comedians. you said that George Burns could not read cue cards. Was that because he couldn't read, or why? What was the story with that?
He was dyslexic. He could not read. He could not. So what? We gave George Burns this script, and his guy that he worked with said, "I'll have to read it to him," because George Burns could not read. But George Burns was one of my first shows with Dinah Shore, and he would stand beside me and make suggestions. He said, "Why don't you tell him to do this, right?" And I'd go up and say, "I think you ought to do whatever," and they would take the suggestions, and the suggestions worked. So everybody thought I was very, very bright young producer. I wasn't bright. George Burns was bright.
He was a real mentor to you then. He had been there since vaudeville.
Oh, yeah. Well, George Burns kind of created vaudeville with Gracie. And he would listen. And then he would say, "Well, go on." And but I learned a lot from George Burns, because he would stand beside me. We brought him in a lot of the Dinah Shore shows. He would stand beside me and say, "Why don't you suggest that they do that?" And I'd say, "I think you ought to do whatever it was." And everybody thought I was very bright. I wasn't bright. I was a good listener. I love George Burns.
Now I want to tell you a little about my next guest, Goldie Hawn. She's expecting a baby soon, so she canceled all her public appearances, all but this show. That's what I call a friend. But she's a very sensitive girl, so I built a very expensive set just so you wouldn't notice her condition. Her husband had all the fun, and I'm out $30,000. Ladies and gentlemen, Goldie Hawn.
I wouldn't have missed George Burns' 100th birthday party for the world. He's amazing. He's so youthful. He coughs like a man of 50. And wasn't it sweet of him to build this set for me?
Goldie, I can't tell you how happy I am to have you at my party.
Well, George, it's just wonderful to be here on your 100th birthday party.
Thank you very much, and it's nice having you here.
Well, I want you to have a happy, happy birthday and many, many more.
Goldie, you don't have to talk so loud.
That's all right. If it would help, I could even talk louder.
Goldie, relax. Talk natural. In fact, you can even whisper.
But if I whisper like I'm whispering now, you're not going to be able to hear me.
Goldie, I just told you.
It's amazing. If the rest of you were as good as your ears, you'd be a tiger.
Goldie, I've got another surprise for you. I'm going to tell you my real age.
No, you don't have to tell me. I got the invitation to your 100th birthday party, and you look marvelous.
Yeah, but you see,
You look as good now as you did when you were 98. You drink martinis. You smoke cigars. You go out dancing. It's amazing. And how a man your age has such vitality, I'll never know.
Well,
you dress sharp. You never have a wrinkle in your clothes.
My wrinkles are under my clothes.
It looks like you never sit down.
I've got thousands
of wrinkles. I'm so proud of you. I am so proud of you.
You are.
Yeah, you have so many interests. I bet you read the paper every day, too.
I'm 83.
You're so well preserved.
I'm 83.
And so well informed.
I'm 83.
George, why do you keep saying you're 83? For 83, you look terrible. For 100, you look sensational.
Okay, kid, I'm 100.
You don't look it.
Goldie, I think we've had enough of this. Ready for the number?
Ready.
Okay. To show you, my gentleman, Morty and Goldie Skee. Two sweethearts in the country down the neighbor say lived happily the whole day long.
Until one day he told her she must go away. She wondered then what could be wrong.
He said, you know, it's true, I love you best of all, yet it's best that we should part.
Just as he went away, he heard his sweetheart say, although he broke her heart, some of these days.
Yes, one of these days.
You're gonna miss me, honey.
You're gonna miss me, baby.
Some of these days.
Oh, some of these days.
You're gonna miss me, only.
You'll be feeling oh so lonely.
Miss my hugging.
Used to love it when I'd hug and squeeze you.
Miss my kissing.
You'd ask for more, and I tease you.
Miss me, honey.
You want me only.
When I.
When you're a million miles away,
so
in the evening when the sun goes down, I'll be on the other side of town.
Remember,
oh, honey, you know, baby,
you had your
you went and had your own sweet way.
And when you leave
comes
me,
tomorrow, said tomorrow,
it's gonna grieve
you
me.
Can bet you're gonna be full of sorrow. You're gonna miss your blue-eyed baby some of these days. Party now and have fun.
I will. Bye.
Goodbye. Poor kid, she'll be walking around with that hedge for 3 more months. Her husband had all the fun.
I also loved Jack Benny. You worked with him a little bit.
Well, Benny was the best listener, and his pauses were great, and he would just wait there for it, right? And Benny, I had a lot of fun with Benny. He came in, did a number of shows, and we would wait for him. Benny's timing was so perfect. He would just wait and wait. Those pauses were forever. And I had a lot of fun with Benny and George Burns and Milton Berle and Sid Caesar, all of those people.
Oh, yes.
Classic comedy, doing more traditional comedy. And when Laugh-In came on, everybody went, wow, this is new and unusual. And everybody wanted to do it because everybody wanted that audience because it was huge. It was just a huge audience. And they wanted to come on and just play and have a good time. So somebody could come on and do a guest shot and only be there for 20 minutes, you know. And that was enormously appealing.
Well, of course, you discovered Goldie Hawn. And after her run on Laugh-In, she made a film, and her very first film, she won an Academy Award. Were you surprised that she became an Academy Award?
I let her out of her contract on Laugh-In to do that movie. And Rowan and Martin never forgave me. They said, how could you have let her go? I said, how could you hold her back? You were going to be there co-starring in a movie. And I couldn't tell her she couldn't do it. But Goldie was, is, and remains one of my favorite people, one of my best friends. And she came on, she was such an innocent. And so I wanted to, I had a meeting with her. Carolyn Raskin suggested there's a girl dancing on the Kovacs show. And so I went down and I saw Goldie Hawn. She was dancing. And she said, I said, I want you to do this show. She said, why? I'm not a comedian. I'm a dancer. I said, that'll be fine. So we gave her an introduction to do. And she screwed it up so bad that it was hysterical. So I said, she said, oh, I'll do it again. I said, no, Goldie. That'll be just fine. And from then on, we never let Goldie rehearse or see what she was going to do. And she remains one of my best friends, but a brilliant, brilliant actress and comedian. But on
were you surprised that she turned out to be such a fine actress?
Not really. It was just, it was what we gave her to do just made her laugh. And if Goldie laughed, the world laughed. And see, what happens is now everybody wants to do another show, another version of Laugh-In was a version of nothing. It was anything happened funny, good, print it. And the idea of a comedy adventure was new then. It would be new now. I mean, I watch the late night shows and they're doing jokes that I couldn't do. and everybody's wearing dark clothes, which I never did. And so Laffin came on with these bright colors, windows opened, and people popped out of the windows doing jokes. And sometimes we'd put a rim shot behind a straight line, and the network would come in and say, "You can't say that." They didn't know what I'd say. We drove the network crazy. But this was 50 years ago. You know, I was young and irreverent and impudent and on my way to becoming rich.
Well, speaking,
you want to combine those things with a touch of arrogance, then you've got something.
But my listeners can't see the lineup of Emmys behind you there, which are, I imagine you stole those from.
Did one win some of those, Writers Guild, Directors Guild. We won a bunch of awards because it was new and unusual, you know.
Is that why you were tapped to do presidential inaugurations? You did a few of those.
Well, no, what happened was they came to me and they said, they'd promised that I would do the inauguration. I said, "I'm not going to do that. I don't even agree with them." And so we did the inauguration, and we had Nixon say, "Sock it to me." And,
that's right. Comedy's
new to me, sock it to me. And he said, so anyhow, I put that on the air reluctantly, and then they said that may have helped elect him. We're not having the fun now. I mean, you could have such fun with the political scene today. You just want to take,
Would you have done Donald Trump's inaugural party if they had asked
you? Oh, would I have done it? Oh, you betcha. I'd have put girls in bikinis. I would have had him pleading guilty. I'd have had a judge standing there with a gavel saying guilty.
The judge.
Because Donald Trump is a walking, breathing punchline. just put a laugh track under what Donald Trump is saying, and you've got a comedy show.
Except it's not funny. But
it is funny if you realize how ridiculous what he's talking about is, you know? You just put a laugh track underneath it and you've got comedy.
Well, in your book, Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy, George Schlatter, you actually say that you think that Donald Trump is using carny techniques that you learned in carnivals.
Well, see, he says outrageous things. And the Democrats are so stupid, they don't come out and say, wait a minute, what are you talking about? All they have to do is challenge him with a comic, and he's a punchline. So I'm really worried about the success of Donald Trump, and I'm hopeful that if the comedians all got together for 10 days, they could get rid of Donald Trump, because he's, when you realize his background and his history is pretty funny, you know?
Bill Maher, Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers, Jimmy Kimmel, they've been hitting him nonstop since 2015.
Well, they are our answer, you know, and I would just like to have them with more airtime and better time periods, because those guys you just mentioned, they may be the answer to our survival, because we're going to have to survive Donald Trump. Biden, I like Biden so much. He's such a sweet man, but I'm afraid he's a little too gentle, because Trump is a walking punchline. You've got to put, I would take Donald Trump, put music and a drummer behind him. When he makes these statements, I do bam, bam. It would sound like a rim shot. Rim shot was what we used to do after jokes.
Well, a lot of people are concerned about Joe Biden's age, but to you, he's young.
Well, to me, yeah. But Biden's a lovely man, and I just would crank up a little more energy if we could. But he certainly is better than the alternative. You know,
By the time Joe Biden was born, you were already bar mitzvah.
That's right. And the only thing about Trump that we hope, if Trump could be in jail by then, you know, and be the first president to give his inaugural address from a jail cell. But we've got to be very careful. We've got to be very, very careful of Donald Trump.
Well, who was the first president whose inauguration you produced?
George Washington. No, I don't know. I think I was the first one I was really involved with. It's right around Nixon sometimes. See, because I realized that Nixon was an absolute fraud.
Yes.
You know, And we just pointed that out, but not in time. Right now, if you take Donald Trump, put some music and put colors behind him with a drummer, and you can get rid of him. But I'm really seriously worried about Donald Trump because he's so outrageous that the public is not aware of the fact that this is a fraud. This is a joke. This is a blackout. You know, I wish they would bring that out, but I can get you canceled talking like that. So be careful.
No, you can't. They don't pay me. But George Schlatter, did you ever want to get a little more political on Laugh-In when the Vietnam War was raging and things like
well,
that?
Well, they said that Laugh-In had a lot to do with ending the Vietnam War. See, it was we did a lot of Vietnam jokes. We did a ton of them. And Tommy Smothers and I were both passionate about the Vietnam War and about our involvement in it. And the difference was they said that Tommy Smothers was canceled because he wouldn't send CBS the scripts.
Yeah.
Tape. And I stayed on. I would send them the tapes, but then I would change it. And Tommy and I were really good friends, and I miss him. But we had a lot of laughs together because we had shared the same political views. The only difference was he fought the network and got canceled. I agreed with the network and went back and changed it to something.
Well, did you ever just put something on the air that they told you not to do?
Oh, yeah. Every week. That was an absolute must. But we would change it just enough and we'd fix it, you know? And we'd say, well, we changed it. They said, well, you made it worse. Oh, gosh. How do you know? How do you like that? comedy is the panacea. Comedy is the lubricant, is the Novocaine of society. And we've got to realize what a desperate need comedy fills. And I'm just worried that you need bright colors and bright people wearing bright color and laughing and having a good time. And into that, put some political humor and you can get rid of Trump.
Well, you did do a thing on Laugh-In where you took things that were not in any way dirty or sexual, like you mentioned Funkin' Wagnalls or the fickle finger of fate. And you
yes.
made them sound as if they were obscene. How about Walnutto?
The way we said it, look that up in your Funkin' Wagnalls, right? And they said, I don't know. But, you know, we looked that up in your Funkin' Wagnalls.
Well, in the writer's room, were they looking, what are some words we can use that will make people think we're talking?
That's right. That's right. And we would sit around in the writer's room and we would bring the writers in and they would all come in with jokes we couldn't do. And we would then turn it just a little bit. And it was not a question of dirty. It was just a question of doing jokes about different things, doing jokes about the presidents, doing jokes about the political scene. And when you realize that Donald Trump is funnier than the comics, if you just put a little thing on it. But I'm worried about him because he's dangerous. I wish we were on the air now with a political show. I would love to have an hour a week to talk about Trump.
Well, let me ask you about the scripts for Laugh-In. At what point?
I would take Donald Trump today and I would take any one of those speeches he makes and I would put music underneath it with rim shots and a laugh track. And I'd be rid of Trump in 2 weeks.
when you were working on the scripts for Laugh-In, did you work ahead of time and then just say, well, this is what we've got for this week? Or how did you manage to corral it all into an hour?
Well, we had Laugh-In writers. Digby Wolf had been a big star in Australia, and he got canceled for taking on the Australian government. And of course, I hired him. He came in. He was a large part of it because he was an outrageous political observer. But we would do jokes on both sides. And then we would do jokes that sounded like we did. Religion was a no-no.
Yeah.
So we said, well, news of the future. And they said, well, that's okay. So we did News of the Future, Dateline the Vatican, 20 years from now, with marriage in the church now an accepted practice, the Archbishop and his lovely bride, the former Sister Mary Catherine, both in this time it's for keeps, if only for the sake of the children. Well, you kind of know she exploded. They said, you can't say. I said, why? We're not talking about it today. It's 20 years from now. Who knows? Anyhow, we put it on the air, and it did. It did explode. But we put a show on Monday night, and Tuesday morning it was in the New York Times with what we had said. And the network didn't like it, but when they saw the ratings, they were more permissive. And, of course, we had the Smothers Brothers on the other side refusing to give them the scripts or wouldn't let them see the show. I made them see the show, and then I changed it. But Tommy and I were good friends. He supplied a very, very fulfilled a need we had at that point.
Well, I remember one of your 20 years in the future jokes that got a huge laugh when Dan Rowan said, President Ronald Reagan, and everybody just exploded with laughter like, oh, yeah. That could ever happen.
See, and if Dan Rowan said it, Dan Rowan was so straight. Dan Rowan was a very literate, intelligent comedian, writer, and very straight. And Dick was so silly. So the combination worked. They were not a part of the original presentation, but we put them in because the network said we had to have a host. Timex, Jim Ellis at Timex, lovely man. He said he would buy the show if we had a host. So we brought Rowan and Martin in, and it worked. You know, we gave them the possessive, which was not too good an idea, but it worked. And they came on, and they would open the show, and they would close the show, and then in the middle they would do a couple of pieces. And the audience loved it because Dan was so attractive and so literate, and Dick was so silly. So we were very, very lucky. Things that should not have worked were the reason for our success. And I would love to see somebody come on today, young, with an irreverent, impudent, articulate sense of humor, because we need it now. We need it now more than we did then.
And well, you're alive and well. Why not produce another show?
I'm 90 years old, and 90? I don't know that they would, but I'm tempted. I am tempted to come back on and say, now look, take one more shot, because we need it now. Maybe you suggest it to a network, and I'll show up in a minute with 7 or 8 young comedy writers who grew up on Laugh-In.
About a comedy show with people all in their 90s? My mother's pretty funny. She's 92.
Well, see, I can't do a show just to appeal to me and your mother. But we do need something to make us laugh. Because it's an automatic thing. When a baby's born, they don't have to teach it how to eat, sleep, cry, or laugh. And the rest of its life, it's telling it when to sleep, not to cry, and to be careful of what it laughs at. Don't be careful of what he laughs at. We don't know what a baby's laughing at, but we know they're laughing. So we need it. It's a bodily function that is absolutely relaxing and fulfilling. And
do you think audiences would find Laugh-In too sexist today? There were too many.
I hope so. I mean, see, Laugh-In survived on the problem, not on the answer. We were the problem, and we were the answer. We're doing a new thing, by the way, where I've taken all of my memories and so forth and put them together into a documentary. It's full of stories. It's like the book, but it's full of stories and full of clips. So, but I look at books, I look at films, I look at the TV, and nobody's taking advantage of the absolutely wonderful atmosphere we have now to be outrageous. You want to see something funny? Take a Donald Trump interview when he's explaining, his relationship with Mrs. Trump.
But are you afraid?
You got a great blackout.
I mean, I know you're concerned about Donald Trump, but are you? I mean, the fact is that people are, in our day, if somebody was exposed as a liar, then they had to leave office and resign. If somebody had a girl on their lap, that was the end of their political career. But here, he's been spanked with a magazine, and he's still got the support of millions of people.
Well, write it down. I mean, he's had a long and suspicious career, and he's now making blackouts and making speeches that are outrageous. And I hope you're right, but I fear that there's enough subhuman brain donors out there that'll vote for him. I like Joe Biden. He just seems to be a little mature and a little slow. But anybody else, put him in there. But Biden's fine, and he could win. And I hope he does, because and by the way, Trump is good for comedy. If they just make it just a little bit more, put some bright colors behind him and silly music, and you got comedy, you know. But we need it. Comedy's the panacea. Comedy's the release. And that could get us through the Donald Trump era.
Well, one of the things that can help with that is this book, Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy from the creator of Laugh-In, George Schlatter, as told to John Max. Who's John Max? Is he a friend of
yours? John Max is one of the funniest comedy writers ever. What happened was people would come in the office and I would tell them stories about my past and my life and whatever. And so my assistant, Martha Bowes, started writing it all down. And so she wrote down everything, including the stories that I can't tell. And we sent John Max, who's probably one of the top comedy writers in the world, and said, John, can you transcribe these stories and take out the stories that
we'll get sued for?
But that's a separate book after I'm gone. And he came out, and we put it out, and the publisher went crazy with it and said he loved it because we need it. And the other thing is this documentary we're doing, where we've collected bits and pieces and stories and whatever and video.
Where and when can we see that?
Probably, I'm working on it, you know.
Well, hurry up, George.
Once in a while, it would be out pretty quick. I've collected all of these bits and pieces and things that strike me funny. And it's a collection of like it's probably 2 hours of just funny stuff. And I don't explain anything. I don't excuse. I don't alibi. I don't apologize for anything. It's just a collection that's like the book, but visual and stories. And the book is doing surprisingly well, because I guess we need something funny. And the book is just funny. It's not a
I'm not surprised. I love the book, and I've been recommending it. The reason it's doing so well is because...
Very nice. Thank you. You're a good friend and a good reader. Thank you.
I can't help but just tell my listeners, I'm looking at the things on your shelf, and I can see the fickle finger of fate is behind you there.
Well, we said we're going to give the finger to, and the network said, you can't say that. Said, we're not going to give that finger, we're going to give a finger. They said, it's still no good. So that's why we did the finger on an angle, and we put wings on it, so we could give the flying fickle finger of fate points with pride to president, whatever. Yeah. And that's why the statue has wings, because it took the onus off of giving people the finger. But it was very...
The Supremes mentioned the fickle finger of fate in one of their songs. Diana Ross, the Supremes.
Really afraid to get the fickle finger. Tonight, the fickle finger of fate points with pride, too. And we would do a political figure and be very nervous.
I can also see there's a gold record. But for what did you get a gold record, George?
For a comedy album, and then Jolene posed for the cover in a lot of albums.
Oh yes, of course. Yeah.
Jolene was quite a very famous model and actress, and married me kind of, she wouldn't marry me. And I said, because she said with the people I was associating with in Vegas at the Frontier and whatever, she said, I'd be dead before I was 30. And I said, well, I don't have to function. I don't have to live with those people. She said, you'll never lose them. Well, took me a year and a half, and I unloaded all of my questionable associations.
Yeah.
I worked in Vegas when Vegas was different than it is now.
Yeah.
And I knew a lot of people, you know, and so when Jolene finally said she would marry me, but only if I'd unload all of these friends of mine, and sure enough, it took me a year and a half, and a lot of them... are no longer with us. All of them are not with us. But it was a very colorful association I had, but I became the most clean-cut, respectable, honorable person in Hollywood.
That's the biggest lie you've told so far. Yeah, I've got, I want everybody to know that Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy by George Schlatter is now out in paperback, and everybody should get it. And George Schlatter, it's just a wonderful pleasure to spend an hour with you. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. An hour? Did we spend an hour?
We did.
That's amazing. I've done television series that didn't last this long. Thank you, though. I want you to have a good time, and stay on the bright side. Stay on the bright side of funny, happy, bright music, bright people, colorful people, and that will find an audience. And you're a good guy, and thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.